Mike Heiser is here. He's the author of The Facade and now a brand new book called The Bible Code Myth. Do you have questions? Well, I know you do. So we're going to open up the phone lines and we're going to pepper Mike with all kinds of questions. Sort of a rapid-fire fashion, I think, over the next hour. That's what's coming. Don't go away. Once again, here is Mike Heiser, author of two very controversial books, very controversial, one called The Facade and now The Bible Code Myth. The only way you could have done better with that is to have said the exploded Bible myth. Let's go to the phones and see what awaits. First time caller line, you're on the air with Mike Heiser. Good morning.
Yes, hello?
Yes, hello.
Yes, sir. This is Mike in Crowley.
Crowley what?
Crowley, Louisiana, pardon me.
Oh, okay, thank you.
It's the rice capital of America. It's a little hick town, but it produces all the rice for the fourth of the world, okay?
Very good.
Okay, Mike, mm-hmm. I read the Bible Code, Michael Drosnin's book.
Right.
And I went through the codes, and I came to the conclusion of the book, as I recall, and I want you to agree because you read the book several times, I'm sure, correct? Mm-hmm. Correct, you did?
Right.
Read the book several times, okay. The thesis on that book, the main code that was explained through their research was the phrase, the Bible Code will save, correct?
Yeah, they mentioned that.
It'll save humanity from destruction.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Right.
Okay, and so fear, and what that, can you interpret what that would mean to me? I mean, I can tell you what I believe in my heart, what that meant to me, that the Bible code will save, because, I mean, if you just give me a moment to explain.
Go ahead.
Okay. Other than the fact that it's self-evident, you mean?
Well, if it says the Bible code will save, and it came out of the book of Daniel, and it is there for us to read, that means it's going to save us from fearing anything but God. See, if we have to fear man and atrocity and Satan and all this stuff, we're falling into a big pilge pot here, you know, and that's what that amounts to. Because if we fear him, we'll believe what his book says, and we won't go whoring after other gods.
Why would you need the Bible code to tell you that?
Yeah.
Why would you need that?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, the book was made to be...
Say that.
Wasn't there something about all these golden idols being destroyed to send you that little message not to go whoring after other gods?
Right, the Jews are going to be deceived by Antichrist when he comes by an idol, and some of us are, in the way, the god of money and lust and all this. You know, I mean, God's trying to guess. He says, I am the Lord your God of Israel and Isaac and Jacob.
And you don't think the New Testament is sufficient for that?
No, I believe that Jesus died on the cross for my sins. I've had enough run-ins with evil just for believing in him.
Yeah, but you're saying why do you need what you've just quoted from the Bible code?
Right.
Okay.
What did you learn from the Bible code?
The Bible code itself, I mean, you read that, it's impossible for that to be a coincidence. And, evidently it came from God's law. It has to be revealed.
All right, let's deal with that question or that statement. It's impossible for it to be a coincidence.
Well, in the appendix to the book, the material there is very clear that, yeah, it is possible for that to be a coincidence. Brendan McKay is probably the mathematician who's put the most time into analyzing the Bible code. And again, since I'm not a mathematician, I let him speak for himself. But he took books such as Moby Dick and, you know, in English and in Hebrew, and I have this, again, in the appendix, and did reproduced the experiment, the original experiment that was the foundation of the Bible code.
Right.
And he found the same kinds of phrases in Moby Dick. Now, is Moby Dick the signature of God? I mean, statistically, it can happen with a book of any length, the same statistical regularity, even the same phrases. He even found that my favorite one is he found in the Hebrew text of Moby Dick, the phrase, no Bible code. McKay's website, and I have it in the appendix, is, you know, he's serious, but there are some really funny examples in there. And I guess to the caller, I would say that what you're telling to me about, you know, your faith, I'm certainly sympathetic with, but you can get the exact same thing from the New Testament or the Old Testament. What did you learn from the Bible code that you couldn't get from the Bible?
Mm-hmm. All right, fair enough. Wildcard Line, you're on the air with Michael Heiser. Hi. Hello.
Hello.
Yes, speak.
Yes, sir. I've just got a question. I wonder, where did your thoughts and patterns and, you know, how you base this book, where did that originate from?
Which book are you referring to?
The Bible code.
Bible code myth?
Yes.
Do you mean how did I come up with the idea for it?
Yeah.
Well, basically it was having to spend hundreds of hours doing textual criticism in graduate school. I mean, when I came across the Bible code book, you know, the initial book, mm-hmm. and you know, read the thesis of what was going on. I mean, I've done textual criticism. Okay, I know that the every letter sequence that is required for the Bible code is a demonstrable myth. I mean, we can't, because we're not omniscient, okay? I'm just not convinced of my own omniscience that I could look at all the manuscripts in the world and all the varying spellings and the fact that the letters have changed and, you know, their shape, and scribes make mistakes. There are places, I have this on the website, where the scribes put little dots above letters. And the dots were to signify the fact, and the rabbis talk about this, that these letters should be erased. Okay? And all the examples I have in here are from the Torah, the most sacred portion of the Hebrew Bible. By the way, if you add all the letters up that they put dots on in the Torah, it's 42 letters. You're over halfway to the magic 77. You know, it just doesn't account for this. I mean, these are the scribes. These are the ones who gave their lives generation after generation, and they did a phenomenal job. The scribes had the entire text of the Hebrew Bible, the whole thing, memorized. And we know that because of the... They didn't have concordances like we do today. They left us notes that tell us, by virtue of how their notes were supposed to be used and what they said of them, that they had the entire thing memorized. I mean, these guys were good, but every once in a while they'd come across a letter that they said, you know, the guy who copied this thing that I'm sitting down here, you know, looking at now, he made a mistake. We're human. A fly got in his way, he got distracted, maybe he had an itch or something. You know, he got something in his eye and he made a mistake, and so they put a little dot over it. We don't want to remove it because it might be sacred. There is some chance, I guess, so I'm going to put a little dot over it, but I'm telling you that this should probably be erased. You count those up, you get 42 of them. Just in the Torah. The Bible code does not account for this, and I'm aware of this kind of thing because I've had to do textual criticism. So that's what birthed the book.
Okay, there you are. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Michael Heiser. Hi.
Hello. Michael, I heard a preacher on the radio who talks a lot about chemtrails mm-hmm. say that there were no dinosaurs.
Mm-hmm.
And
What the two of those have to do with
yeah,
each other.
Yeah, I don't either.
Pardon me?
What do the two have to do with each other?
What do the two have to... Well,
yes, chemtrails and dinosaurs.
The one will identify the preacher to those who know him, and I don't want to say his
okay.
name.
All right.
All right.
And, well, anyway, the first, very first sentence in the book of Genesis, mm-hmm. Bible scholars have debated over it. I wonder how you come out on it. And my second question has to do with your hierarchy of God, and I want to ask you about an analogy to Henry Ford and the Ford Motor Company.
What?
Let me go back to the first one, though. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, mm-hmm. and some scholars say that it should be translated, and the earth became formless, a formless wasteland.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, at some event, perhaps millions of years or even billions after its original creation, caused something to happen to the earth that wasn't originally there. Do you join the side of those translators?
Well, what you're articulating there is basically the gist of what's called the gap theory. That Genesis 1:1 does not describe the initial, it could describe the initial creation event, but something happened between 1:1 and 1:2 that caused the earth to become, you know, this wasteland. Okay, and then, of course, in between those two verses, you can put all the millions of years, and God comes back and finishes the job. I personally don't like the gap theory, although grammatically, from a translation perspective, that translation is possible. Okay, I actually do not prefer, although I think that the text certainly, you know, could say this, I actually don't prefer the literal 24-hour creationist view. That, Art, you've had Hugh Ross on your show before.
Oh, yes.
I'm actually closer to him. I think that Genesis 1:1 doesn't actually articulate the initial creative event. I do think that God did create all matter, but I think you have to go elsewhere in the Bible for that. And the reason I say that is because the first word in the Hebrew Bible, Bereshit, okay, the be sound lacks in grammar what we call the article, the word the. So what you should try to do is translate the verse without using the word the. And what you get is in beginning or to begin with or something like that. So it's not, if it was in the beginning, the word would actually be ba reshit. So the way that it's actually pointed, the vowels that were put in, could suggest that what you have going on in Genesis 1:1 is a second series of creative activity on God's part, and the initial creation happened elsewhere. Now, that's different than the gap theory, but as far as the millions and millions of years thing, it sort of would accomplish the same thing. And I think that view is viable. I think the traditional 24-hour day view is viable from the text. The text allows either option.
All right. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Mike Heiser. Hi.
Art, I'm really glad that you didn't fluff this off on Ian. I like the way you're handling this, too. I have a couple of questions, three of them.
Wait a minute. I did not slough anything off. I was dying. I had a near-death experience with the flu. I want to keep that straight. All right, go ahead.
First of all, I recognize just by the way he's talking that Mike Heiser is a scholar in Hebrew. I just started learning Hebrew myself, and. But the first question is, why do you think that the Trinity is a foundational belief for Christianity?
Okay, you're going to go one at a time?
Oh, yeah, I'll give them to you all at once, I guess.
Well, it's up to you.
One of the other ones is Hebrew from, I've just at a very beginning level, but Hebrew from the rabbi I'm learning from says that Hebrew has at least four different interpretations and as many as 10. And do you agree with that? And
well, I don't know what he's talking about in terms of interpretations. I mean, you're looking at,
well, there's,
you're looking at letters and words and sentences.
Yeah, there's four different levels of what it can say, and as many as 10 different levels of what it can say.
I got you. So you're talking about methods of interpretation.
And the last question is the big question. I want to know if any of your books have any more that talks about the Grays and the 666 connection and that sort of thing.
All right.
Okay, well, let's take the last one first because that's the quickest. The only thing you're going to get there is the little bit that's alluded to in the facade. There's a little bit more on the website. You'd have to go up to the website, facadenovel.com, and then hit position papers and then look for the mention of the possible Antichrist thing and Irenaeus. So that's really what you're going to get there. Back to the second one, the interpretations. It isn't just Jewish interpreters, but throughout history, people have, tried, it would be a good way to put it. They've tried different methods of interpretation. There's no requirement that you go beyond what we would call a face value or an authorial intention or literal. I mean, to someone who's in hermeneutics, they know I'm using these imprecisely, and that's okay. But the short answer is, yeah. I mean, you can have different approaches to the text. The only thing I don't like about approaches that are not linked to grammar and linked to the language itself is that there's an inherent subjectivity to them. In other words, let's just say the allegorical method of interpretation.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we know what the text would mean if we just take the words at face value, but now let's look for some deeper hidden symbolic meaning or allegorical meaning. I'm not denying that there could be some of that. Okay, I think the way the New Testament writers quote the Old Testament, that is something that needs to be considered. the problem that I don't, or the problem with it is that where's the litmus test? I mean, where are the limits? I mean, I could go there and say, well, allegorically, I think this verse means that pigs fly. I mean, there are no rules, you know, once you get out of the text and just start using your imagination. I think if you're going to do that, you need to link your allegorical interpretation to something else that's in the text, in the Bible, somewhere else, and that gives you some kind of mooring for it. The first question, why is the Trinity foundational? I would answer that by saying that basically, in church history terms, the Trinity was articulated and, of course, defended and chosen as the correct theological position all the way back at the Council of Nicaea in 325. Of course, that gives rise to the question, well, didn't they just invent the doctrine there? The answer is no. It was a textual debate. Okay, both Arius, on the one hand, that thought that Jesus was created, the highest creation, but, of course, was not pre-existent. And, of course, Trinitarianism said that he was pre-existent because of John 1 and other passages. I mean, what they were doing was they were trying to come to grips with what the apostles wrote. So it was a textual debate. And I believe that the correct side won out textually. I have a lot of sympathy, you know, not theologically, for the other side. I have sympathy because the problem is so difficult. What Arius was doing is he was looking back, you know, you have Jewish people doing this in between the Testaments, which is my dissertation area, trying to figure out, okay, here you have Daniel 7. There's the Ancient of Days sitting on the throne. Well, we know who that is. That's God. But the passage says there's more than one throne there. And then there's somebody that's called the Son of Man comes along, and God hands him everlasting dominion and all power. Who's that? Well, you know, I would say here you have a divine council scene, and the individual that this is handed to is the second person of the Trinity, Christ. Why? Because in the New Testament, the Son of Man connection is made. Now, I can do that because I have the New Testament, and I have a Semitic background. But, you know, some of these people who were trying to hammer this out just didn't have... They, you know, either manuscripts hadn't been discovered, they hadn't, you know, looked at things again as a Semite would look at them. This was a struggle. And so I think all the way back to the text, the apostolic text, that the Trinitarian doctrine is there, even though it was only hashed out in 325. Okay. That's why I say it's foundational.
All right. First time caller line, you're on the air with Mike Heiser. Hi.
Hi, Mike. Hi, Art.
Hi.
Doug in Miami listening on 610 WIOD.
Yes, sir.
I'd like to ask Mike if he thinks there might be a message hidden in the genealogy of the names from Adam to Noah. If you take the 10 names, might want to list these vertically and put a translation to the side. Adam, Seth, Enosh, Kenan, Mahalalel, Jared, Enoch, Methuselah, Lamech, and Noah, that Adam translates to man, Seth to appointed, Enosh, mortal, Kenan, sorrow, Mahalalel, the blessed God, Jared, shall come down, Enoch, teaching, Methuselah, his death shall bring, Lamech, the despairing, and Noah, rest or comfort, put all together would be a message in the earliest chapters of Genesis that God had already laid out his plan for the redemption of mankind in saying that man is appointed mortal sorrow, but the blessed God shall come down teaching, that his death shall bring the despairing rest.
All right. I appreciate your call, sir, but I think basically you're suggesting that you could do basically the same thing with a Harry Potter book, right?
Well, I think I can take this after the break. I hear the music.
Yeah, it's musicking. That's right. But that you could take any text, string all the letters together, put them vertical if you wish, and come up with meaningful phrases.
He's saying taking the names, not just the letters. Now that is different. So we can take that after.
They're still made up of letters, though, right?
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. But they're not sequential in this case.
All right. We'll be right back.
What you gonna do when they come for you? When you were eight and you had that dream, you go to school and learn the golden rule. So why are you acting like a bloody fool?